business and humanity are constantly changing, and to meet them where it matters, the creative industry also needs to evolve. So we start the year with a conversation that I had with Charlie Stewart, the CEO of Roger Wilco, about what some of these changes mean, why purpose matters, and why they became B Corp certified recently as a result of these changes that humanity is experiencing.
There's an awful lot of talk in the world, talk around purpose, talk around we're good because we do good things, but there are very few standards. There are very few opportunities for people to actually evidence the value that they do bring. And B Corp, to our minds, is the gold standard in that respect.
We also discuss why creative effectiveness has become such an important topic in marketing and advertising.
Well, I think as a starting point, I love the fact that we're talking about effectiveness in the context of creativity. For too long, we have just looked at the pretty picture. We've looked at the great conceptual piece of work, but we've not joined that through to the bottom line.
This forms part of our CEO series that we started recently. So enjoy the show, subscribe, and please share the lead creative with your network. Welcome to the Lead Creative Podcast, where we talk to creative industry leaders, influencers, and brands. We discuss the strategies that influence brand thinking and shape industries. Thought leaders and heads of agencies let us in on some of their thinking and insights. I'm your host, Mongezi Mthathi. Enjoy the show, and please share and subscribe. Charlie, thanks for making the time to talk to us on the Lead Creative as we kick off the new year. Just as a starting point, you've got marketing as one of your core interests. You also have art as one of those things that you really, really love. What is it about these two things that kind of connects and make you interested in two of them the way that you are?
I think it's all about interpretation, Mo. We can all look at the same thing and see it slightly differently. And, you know, I see that in the art that I collect. When friends come around and look at a picture, they always interpret things in a slightly different way to the way I interpret things. Similarly, you know, exactly the same happens with good marketing campaigns. A campaign can mean one thing to one person and something else entirely to somebody different. And, you know, I love that. I suppose there's an element of juxtaposition. There's an element of the unknown, of not really being able to understand and put your finger on quite what it is that triggers the emotional response. So beauty is in the eye of the beholder, as they say.
And while sticking with this idea of interpretation, because I think interpretation has in many ways affects both marketing and business, as well as society as a whole. There's a change that Roger Wilco has instituted in the business in recent times, which, in my opinion, business in some ways, of course, has, you know, takes a direction that they believe can make the most impact on both the business and humanity. And this is, of course, becoming a member of B Corp. Can you firstly tell us what B Corp is and what is it about humanity and business that you believe is changing for you to go that direction?
So B Corp's a global body that certifies businesses based on a triple bottom line assessment that looks at their impact on people, both the people that are employed in the business, but also in the broader communities in which they operate. It looks at environmental impact, and ultimately it looks at profit. Because without profit, businesses would not be able to deliver effectively on the other two elements. It's a fascinating movement, and it's something that I wish that we had discovered many years ago, because it really speaks directly to the things that interest us, the things that enliven us, the things that keep us awake and committed to our journey as a business in South Africa. And, you know, we embarked on the B Corp process, the B Corp journey, about 12 months ago, really to try to find a way of evidencing a lot of the work that we currently do. There's an awful lot of talk in the world talk around purpose, talk around we're good because we do good things. But there are very few standards. There are very few opportunities for people to actually evidence the value that they do bring. And B Corp, to our minds, is the gold standard in that respect. It's been around for, probably 20 odd years, and it really does attract some of the most enlightened and progressive organizations in the world who've signed up and have been B Corp certified.
How then does I suppose, being B Corp certified separate you from, you know, the rest of the agencies and businesses out there that aren't? Because, I mean, it is about people, planet, and profits, but all businesses or most businesses would say they are about that. So what's this differentiation within B Corp that makes the agency and agency work and thinking different or distinguished in some way?
I think from our perspective, we started the journey coming out of COVID. We saw significant cultural impact on the business. COVID was a very difficult time for most organizations. And, you know, things like work from home created a huge dissonance in the workplace. People weren't connecting with their colleagues. And, you know, we started to see staff attrition rates grow to an uncomfortable level. And we realized we needed to do a bit of a reset. And part of the thinking around that reset was, how do we create a culture within the organization that demonstrates we do actually stand for something, that demonstrates that we care? And, you know, B Corp gave us that platform. It gave us the opportunity to do a bit of a hard reset, to think about what's the impact that we have on the daily lives of our staff, what's the impact we have in the communities in which we operate, how are we able to demonstrate that we want to be a force for good, that we want to work with organizations that are aligned to our value systems. And I think that the summation of all of that was this evidence, this certification that says, yeah, these guys actually do walk the talk. They're being honest, they're being transparent. They are committed to delivering value beyond the standard nature of relationships that we have with the people who work here, our colleagues, and the clients that we serve. So as a differentiator, I think it enables us to... I think it enables us to really demonstrate that we are true to our word. And I really believe that over the course of the next few years, it will be seen in the tenure that our employees have. I think people will want to come and work at Roger Wilco. And I think the people currently working at Roger Wilco will want to stay at Roger Wilco. I think as we see elements like ESG, There's been an awful lot of fluff around purpose over the last few years, and I think particularly around stuff like ESG, but it is hypercritical. We're all aware that the planet's burning. We're all aware that resources are finite. We're all aware that we need to be more conscious in our decision-making. And I'm pretty certain that that level of scrutiny is going to start entering into a lot of client-side conversations where people are looking for organizations and service providers that are aligned and can truly demonstrably show that they are wedded to making a difference and to creating a better world where there's more equality for all.
Yeah. You mentioned purpose, and purpose is really a big thing around this change. But marketing has been divided on this idea of purpose. Some feel it's not measurable as a business sort of imperative, and others kind of lean into it. Why is purpose so important, and equally, why is marketing so divided about purpose?
I think it's critical, because the one thing that all marketing campaigns want to do is create a level of engagement with their target audience. It doesn't matter whether you're in the B2B space or the B2C space. You're looking to create a familiarity and an association with your customer. And purpose typically demonstrates shared value. And shared value is the best way to say, hey, we're like you. Come and partner with us. Buy from us. So I think that's why we're leaning into it across, you know, all industry verticals. Why has it been divisive? I think it's been divisive because some people have looked to develop purpose-led campaigns that are truly authentic, You can see the DNA of the brand is baked into those campaigns. Other organizations have seen their competitors doing it and thinking, oh, well, if they're doing something that's purpose related, then we need to. And that's where you begin to see, I don't know, a bit of masquerading going on. You begin to see organizations that really are not true to the belief. And so that's when purpose fails. I think that there are lots of lazy marketers out there who are looking to take shortcuts. They see purpose as being a silver bullet, but they're not prepared to put the hard yards in to win that purpose or to define that purpose.
Yeah. So I want to lean into to that specifically, this idea that, you know, purpose becomes a topical thing. You see marketers talk about it, and then you see some campaigns kind of really live up to it. You see business live up to purpose. How then do we go from purpose being a talking point, being a mission statement, being something that we talk about, to it trickling down to the creative work that a business puts out there, that a marketer briefs into a creative agency? How does it play out? Where are some examples in society that we could say that is purpose playing out from a brand to the creative work that we're seeing and experiencing?
I think the big standout purpose campaign over the last few years has probably been Dove. I don't think anybody would dispute that. The way that they have managed to portray an image of a woman that is realistic. They've created a series of marketing campaigns that are truly authentic, that have evolved away from this stereotypical, you know, a woman needs to be, you know, 6 foot tall, slim and beautiful, into a very real world. I think that the next step really becomes evidencing the impact and the value of purpose-led campaigns. Peter Field and the Institute of Marketing Practitioners ran a study a few years ago. It was quite controversial, but its findings were that campaigns that had purpose baked into them, an effective purpose baked into them, were significantly more successful than campaigns that didn't. And I think that is the hard evidence that encourages more people to invest in purpose, because they see that purpose done well makes money. And again, I mean, coming back to B Corp and why I think B Corp is so special is that it has that focus on purpose, but it also has the focus on profit. And the two have got to work hand in hand. You would very quickly run a business into the ground if you focused on purpose without thinking about the profit motive. You're not going to see growth. You're not going to see further employment within your organization. So I think wedding the commercial objective of purpose to the inherent nature of purpose is what works, and you know, what really drives it. Locally, we've seen, I think, a much stronger focus on purpose since the Effie Awards came into South Africa 4 years ago in 2020. We're now seeing campaigns and a lot of the bigger awards saying, guys, let's try and bake efficacy into campaigns, but let's try and land campaigns that stand for something, that are going to deliver more than just a sale. They're going to deliver something that is resonant, that truly engages the audiences and the communities that it's looking to serve.
If you're enjoying The Lead Creative, please share this episode with your network and hit follow or subscribe. Enjoy the show. How do you see this changing the sort of the future, I suppose, of marketing and advertising? This notion that we are focusing a lot more on purpose, because especially on efficacy more than purpose. We've been talking about purpose for so long that everything is purpose now. Creative effectiveness, because there was a time when, you know, when we were celebrating the big brand, the real, the brand work and the brand message. And now it's more about creative effectiveness. And as we go into the space of creative effectiveness, you're also starting to see, or at least marketers are talking about economic pressures, the fact that there's a lot of short-term focus in the work that they have to do. How do you see this changing how creativity and marketing in general will then present in society?
Well, I think as a starting point, I love the fact that we're talking about effectiveness in the context of creativity. For too long, we have just looked at the pretty picture. We've looked at the great conceptual piece of work, but we've not joined that through to the bottom line. It's a bit of a paradox because years back, if you go back to the 1960s and 1970s, when people like David Ogilvy were writing beautiful copy, it was very sales oriented. I mean, I think that David Ogilvy began his life as a direct marketer. He was very conversion oriented. And we then moved into a space probably in the 80s, 90s, 2000s, where the pretty picture was everything. Now we're seeing that wheel come back to how do we demonstrate that the work that we have delivered has generated the results that we wanted to see. And I suspect that there's an element of the CMO sitting in the boardroom being drilled by the finance director and having to demonstrate that there is a return on investment from his work. The award shows are certainly helping in that context, and we're seeing a lot more focus on businesses being able to show that they got some results from their campaigns. I think digital has helped in that respect. I think digital's actually been a bit of a blessing and been a bit of a curse. I say it's helped because activities and campaigns are far more measurable in a digital universe than they are in a traditional environment. The curse side of it is that it might have put too much attention and too much focus on performance marketing to the detriment of proper brand building. I think that it's understandable that in order to achieve shareholder value, people are going to be focusing on low-hanging fruit and performance marketing, slapping some budget into Google search or into paid social. Allows you to target an audience and turn that audience quite quickly into a sales funnel. But it does dilute the impact of brand if you invest too much of your time and energy in that.
To that end, one of the things that has come up in the past year about awards in South Africa showing up in awards shows and just generally brands showing up in awards shows is this sort of, I mean, I mentioned the short-term approach, but also what you've just mentioned, that we want to very quickly get to a sale and not build the brand. One of the things that I'm asking brands on the one side, and I'd be interested to hear your view on it, is what then does this mean for brands in future? Because, I think Charles Basil, whom we spoke to, said something like, if you don't build brand, if you don't work on campaigns that build brand, you're going to have to come back 2 years later to do that hard work. You're going to have to come back a year later to do that hard work. Why are brands suddenly responding differently to economic pressures now when they've always had economic pressures and they've always seen the value of doing long-term work?
Yeah, it's absolutely perplexing. I think that a big part of it is the immediacy of performance and of short-term revenue generating campaigns. The thing that intrigues me about life, and this is a statement about life in general, is that people always think that there's a better way. There's an either or, that if I do this, I shouldn't do that. I must put all of my eggs into this basket, because that's the basket that's going to deliver me the greatest rewards, the greatest return on investment. Why not do both? We all know that you can do both. You can have a bit of this and a bit of that. And there's been so much research produced over the years, and latterly by Les Burnett and Pete Fields, on the impact of bothism, the long and the short of it. One of the better books that's been written in the marketing industry in many, many, many years. And their research shows conclusively that if you are able to focus the majority of your budget on brand building and then ramp in some performance marketing campaigns, some short-term activations to support the brand, you will see a significant uplift in sales and in excess share of voice and in market share. And the two support each other, so that run in conjunction, the value of the output is far greater than the value that would be achieved if you were to run a brand campaign and in a separate point in time run a performance campaign. So it really is one of those moments where 1 plus 1 equals 2.5, not 1 plus 1 equals 2. And I think that, there's just too much pressure on CMOs. People are looking for short-term results. We've come out of a recession, we've come out of COVID. In a South African context, the economy is in a mess. And so people naturally are going to be looking for short-term success. But that really is to the detriment of long-term sustainability and survival. So I really hope that we begin to see, and I sense that we are seeing it. I sense that there has been a little bit of a correction and that we're seeing more work being put into brand. I'd love to see that work that's being put into brand in a South African context start winning some of the awards at the global shows. We've had a fairly dismal performance over the last few years.
Humanity is expecting more of business now. Humanity is expecting business to be more, I suppose, responsible, more conscious, more interested, I suppose, in people's wellness, well-being, and the development of humanity. Will we see newer brands, new challenger brands rise to what these legacy brands have become without them paying attention to what humanity is doing? Brands that only focus on, I suppose, the consumer for the purposes of people just consuming brands and products. Where are things going in terms of that? Because I think to your point on purpose earlier, I think humanity kind of wants to, business should meet humanity where we are and vice versa. Will we see that still happening? Or is it something where brands have to be more conscious to grow to what the legacy brands that we've come to know have grown to?
I think there are probably two different routes that brands can take. You can either take the approach of an organization like Liquid Death, which has been all over LinkedIn and social media in recent months, where they've created an entire new category of ready-to-go drinks. They put water into tin cans. Their ambition, their stated goal, I am sure, was not to be recyclable, to not take single-use plastic out of circulation, but they're achieving that. And I'm sure that a fair amount of their sales are coming from people who don't want to buy a bottle of water. They want to buy a can. They want to buy something that's recyclable. So although purpose might not be at the core of their mission, certainly their environmental focus is having some benefit. The flip side of that is a brand like Dove that really does put purpose heart and center and stands out and delivers. And then I guess you've got the brands that really don't care, the brands that are more focused on profit today. I think there's a place for all of them. I don't think that we're ever going to get into a space where people decide that they are only going to buy from a brand that is purpose driven and purpose centric. But I do think that as we begin to focus more on long-term loyalty and finding ways of locking customers in, it makes an awful lot of sense to try to find some affinity with the customer, to demonstrate to the customer that you and them have shared values. And that really has got to be a sweet spot for organizations. It's so expensive and so difficult to acquire a new customer, yet it's paradoxically easy, if your service delivery is good and your product or service is fit for purpose, to retain that customer. And having shared values takes you a great deal closer to building that lifetime relationship.
There's a sort of balancing act that agencies kind of have to play, in essence, where the once smaller, edgier boutique agency has now become a medium, in some instances, large agency. How do you remain edgy as an agency when your clients are becoming more and more traditional and bigger in their approach? How do you maintain the things that made you the small, boutique challenger when you become bigger as an agency?
Sure. Yeah, that is quite a tough one. I think at the heart of it, it's about remaining entrepreneurial and not being afraid to fail. Certainly wearing a Rog Wilco hat, we're constantly trying to almost to fail forward. We know that we need to make some mistakes. We can't win every decision that we make. So we need to take brave decisions in the knowledge that some of them won't play out so that we can learn from them and we can see what will work. And I think that because we are an independent agency, we have the luxury of being able to do that. We're answerable really only to ourselves as shareholders. So that gives us a lot more flexibility than would be the case in an organization that has external shareholders. I think a lot of it is about trying to do the right thing. Do take actions and decisions that are not in your own direct interests, that are in the interests of the longer term. And the longer term might mean taking decisions to not work with a client in a disruptive industry. You know, the short-term benefit could be that, you know, it brings revenue and it brings profit in, it enables us to go on a bit of a growth spurt. But if that's not true to our sense of identity or true to who we want to be, then it's very easy for us as an independent agency to say, no, we are not going to work with a mining giant. We're not going to work with a fossil fuel company, because that would be, you know, standing against where we really want to be. So there's an element of trying to retain that, you know, freshness, that freedom of choice as the agency grows. And, you know, that in turn is about empowering the next generation of leaders who come through the business to get into the mindset of being entrepreneurial. They may not have founded the business, but they're running it right now. And they need to make their own mistakes. They need to do so knowing that they may be held accountable for them, but they're not going to be judged on them. They're not going to be career-threatening decisions that they make or bad calls that they make. So really just trying to cultivate and maintain that sense of entrepreneurialism and aligning that with being relevant and keeping a singular focus on outcomes. You know, our clients give us money to spend on marketing campaigns, not because they want to look pretty or look good, but because they ultimately want to make money themselves. They're looking for a return on investment. So we must be very, very centered around that. Every rand that a client gives us, we need to treat as though it was a rand of our own money. If we do that, then we have a proper sense of fiduciary responsibility, and that in turn translates into marketing done right.
So it's the 9th anniversary of your book on B2B marketing, and we are seeing the rise of B2B creativity across all spheres. So if you go to LinkedIn today, it looks fundamentally different to what it did 5 years ago, to what these platforms did 5 years ago, especially from a B2B front. 9 years in, what trends have you seen play out in B2B marketing, and what are some of the major changes that have occurred over the past 9 years?
I think when we wrote the book, there was a sense that organizations didn't and couldn't differentiate between marketing and sales in the B2B space. They thought they were one and the same thing. Over the last 5 or 6 years, I've seen people beginning to understand that there is a substantial difference between spending a few million on a big piece of yellow metal that's supposed to move Earth to the decision making process that a consumer will go through when they're buying a tube of toothpaste in a supermarket. There's also an understanding that the person who signs the check for that big piece of machinery is not going to do it alone. There are going to be an awful lot of people around them guiding them on that decision-making process and ultimately influencing it. So we're beginning to see B2B marketing strategies come through that are designed to target the influencers, not just the decision makers. And I think that's really important. Then the other big difference, and the evident, obvious difference, and I think the one that you're referring to with a lot of the content we're seeing in social media and the like, is the introduction of much stronger creativity into the B2B space and a lot more emotive creativity. I think, again, there's a recognition that somebody who's a decision maker in a large corporate is also a human being. That person when they get home in the evening, you know, they're engaging with more emotive content. And so why should B2B content not be emotive? Why should it not also try to, you know, touch heartstrings and, you know, tap into, you know, the sense of humanity that we all embrace?
One of the things that marketers have been talking about quite a lot is the significance of AI in their work, especially within the B2B space, alongside the challenge of scale within B2B marketing. How do you see AI playing a role in helping business scale their B2B marketing?
I think there are too many people who are looking to AI as being a silver bullet right now. AI is in its infancy, and it's going to take a long time before it really becomes fit for purpose in every space. We're certainly seeing great use cases for AI with synthetic data, for example. So let's say you're a marketing director of a large consulting firm, and you want to understand what your end customers are concerned about. You could utilize one of the synthetic data engines and seed it with a little bit of customer insight and ask it to extrapolate that. So you're able to build out a much greater body of research and insight around what are the pressures that your customers are facing and why are they making the purchasing decisions that they are. So I think there's massive scope. And I think that's probably the single biggest use case that I see for AI in a B2B context right now is research and insight. There are definitely opportunities to use AI for, I suppose, to catalyze content ideas. I hate the idea of AI writing content. In fact, I mean, it's evident to most of us when a piece of AI generated content is put in front of us, particularly something that comes out of ChatGPT that uses Oxford commas and Zs and unnecessary superlatives. I mean, it will get a lot better, but I think it can be a good starting point, you know, for people who are under pressure to deliver quickly, but it cannot be the finished product. So I think there are opportunities there. There are opportunities to use it with in a media landscape. Again, lots of caveats apply, but from a digital media perspective, most of the big publishers, the Metas, the Googles, are using AI elements to refine targeting, to refine personalization, to give guidance on which creative is working better, and to then optimize those campaigns. The reason I say that there are caveats here is that I think a lot of the machine learning and the artificial intelligence engines are not yet sufficiently advanced to make a decision as to what is the right outcome that we want to see. Just by way of simple example, you might be using a piece of AI to flight an advert to an audience, and the AI will say, okay, this one is working better than that one, therefore let's go and target this audience with that creative. If the output is inconsistent with your end goal, then you might waste an awful lot of money. Simply put, if you're directing people to a contact form that has got two drop-down options on a website, one of those drop-down options might be inquire for more information about the product. The other one might be complain about the product. And the AI is told just to look at web form submissions. It might think that you're getting a ton of web form submissions that is a positive thing, but if all those submissions are complaints, then that's a very negative thing. So you don't really want to be putting too much time and energy and marketing spend exposing your brand to complainers.
If you're enjoying The Lead Creative, please share this episode with your network and hit follow or subscribe. Enjoy the show. In opinion pieces and writing that marketers are putting out there, something that is definitely emerging is this notion that CMOs are now reducing agency rates for use of AI in their creative work, or when AI is found to have been used in their creative work. And yet, on the other hand, AI helps with the scale, with, you know, generating creative ideas, as you've said, with synthetic data and all of these other things. How do we balance that? How do we balance the idea of agencies not, you know, being affected in terms of the rates, but while still increasing scale and where possible, utilizing AI to support their work?
Yeah, it's a really, really difficult one. I mean, it's a true conundrum right now, largely because we are still in the early days of AI and we're not entirely sure how we can use it to best effect. My worry, and you know, it's an evident worry, is that if you start putting pressure on fees, those agencies are not going to be able to run profitably. That means that they're going to probably start losing seniors and hiring juniors. That means that all of the skill and insight that comes from people who spent decades working in the industry is going to disappear. And the ultimate consequence of that is that clients are going to be unhappy because they're not going to be getting great, well thought through ideas that are based on collective experience. They're going to be getting hunches. They're going to be getting guesses from lighties. So there's a real inherent danger that agencies are going to find themselves being put under too much pressure to optimize cost, and it's going to be a zero-sum game. And I think that, you know, it manifests itself in lots of different ways. I mean, years back, there was the old, you know, 80-20 rule around 80% of my budget, my spend must go into amplification, into media, 20% into production. I think that that's been pretty much busted. And I think many people still ascribe to it, but it's an interesting principle. And, you know, it, even back then, I think, you know, it was probably relevant because there were relatively few media platforms. You had TVCs, you had some radio, some print, a little bit of out of home. Today, you've got a myriad of different channels. And, you know, with all of the digital stuff coming through, it means that so much more work needs to go into the production to make sure that every asset that an organization is using to try and engage an audience is fit for purpose, both for the channel that it's being flighted on, but also for the audience that it's being targeted to. So I would argue that far more money should be spent on production so that we can produce top-notch assets that are really going to deliver on their purpose and on their intent, rather than trying to use, you know, the argument that, oh, you're using AI to, you know, to catalyze a couple of content ideas, therefore we're going to slash your fees. Clever brands are going to recognize that the greater investment they make in human capital, in employing agencies who have really, really talented individuals, they're the ones who are going to be the winners, because everybody else is going to be scrabbling around with pieces of work that just are not fit for purpose.
We've spoken about purpose. We've spoken about B2B creativity. We've spoken about the impact of the creative industry on business and all of that. Something that you've been doing for the past 6 years is creating the South African Digital Customer Experience Report. What are you finding? What's the one sort of or two key findings that you've been following over the past 6 years that businesses are either missing out on, or that consumers are really asking for from business, and they kind of almost keep missing it or not getting it right from a customer experience perspective?
I think the big one, the big takeout, is that consumers like to hear what other people's experience of buying a product or a service was. And that's far more important than what the brand says. We've been asking people about the importance, the significance of reviews in influencing decisions for the last 4 or 5 years. And in each of the last 4 studies, reviews have been the number 1, number 2, number 3, and number 4 sources of information that people go to before they go and buy stuff. The reason I say number 1, number 2, number 3, and number 4 is that the most important source of information is a review that's posted on a company's website. So, you know, for example, Takealot with all of its reviews. The second most important is reviews on social media. So somebody saying, I bought this, it was really cool. The third most important is word of mouth. what your friends, your family, your colleagues say about products and services to your face. The fourth most important is, you know, when we're skeptical, we go to Hello Peter. We want to see who's had a bad experience. How did the company respond to that bad experience? Those four come before corporate advertising and promotional material. That was the fifth greatest source of help for people when they're considering buying a product or a service. So I just don't think people are leaning into the power of reviews enough. You know, we know word of mouth. I mean, everybody talks about word of mouth being important. But why are brands, why are organizations not doing more to garner good reviews? Another question that we always ask in the survey is, what do you do when you have a good experience? People share news of a good experience. They also share news of a bad experience. And if they have a good experience, they demonstrably will buy more from organizations. And they'll go and tell everybody else. So you really get, you know, the power of two. You get, I'm going to go and buy from you again, and I'm going to go and tell other people to buy from you. So deliver a great experience, and you will see a significant elevation in your revenue, and, you know, if you're running a proper business, and your profit. So focus on that. Focus on customer sentiment. Focus on what the customer is telling you, and where they're giving negative feedback, or whether giving any feedback at all, engage with them, talk to them, say thanks, you know, give them a thumbs up for saying something positive about you, so that you're able to engage them in a conversation, in a dialogue, because that dialogue is going to be very beneficial for you as an organization.
One of the things that, or ways that some businesses have tried to short circuit this process is through influencer marketing. So where do reviews and influencer marketing kind of meet?
I think it comes down, I mean, it really just comes down to authenticity. I think any time that an influencer is being used, they must disclose it. I mean, legally, they're supposed to disclose it if you want to adhere to any of the standards that run through our industry. But I also think influencers need to be relevant and aligned with the target audience. I'm not a big fan of macro influencers. I think that it can be very vanilla, or it can really seem as though you're just trying to buy, you know, a spot of this person's fame in the hope that some of the luster rubs off onto your brand. Where it can and does work really effectively is where people use micro influencers, you know, particularly in very niche communities where there are totally aligned and shared values. So a big drill into that space. You know, we've seen influencer marketing certainly grow significantly in South Africa over the last few years, but the growth in spend by brand seems to be escalating at a far greater level than the appreciation by consumers of influencers, and the sentiment from consumers as to the extent to which influencers drive purchasing behavior.
Charlie, we usually have a question that our guest leaves for our next guest, and our previous guest was the Group Chief Marketing Officer and Corporate Affairs Officer of APSA, Sydney Mbele. And the question he left for you really starts out with the fact that there's conversations playing out within marketing around measurement, because measurement builds credibility. And his question is, what is your take on what the next frontier is as far as marketing measurement is concerned?
You know what they say, the more things change, the more they stay the same. I think that the next frontier is probably one of the earliest frontiers, and it's one that we don't put enough focus and attention on. And that is, how do we calculate customer lifetime value? We know that if we engage and get a customer to buy from us once, they will likely buy from us again and again and again, unless we disappoint either in the with an inferior product or service, or with very poor delivery. I just don't think we spend enough time looking at loyalty, looking at customer retention. I think we spend far too much time focused on acquisition, and, you know, all too many brands have this sort of leaky bucket mentality, where we know people are going to fall out the bottom. So let's just try and throw as many into the top as we can. And hopefully we put more into the top than fall out the bottom of the bucket. And that's simply because we're not spending enough time looking at how do we calculate customer lifetime value? How do we calculate the impact of good customer experience? And so I would really urge every brand to be thinking about that and trying to model it. And if you find the perfect model, please share it with me, because I think we're all struggling with it.
Yeah, no, great. Yeah, great point. Great point there. And now finally, what question would you like to leave for our next guest in relation to marketing, creativity, or life?
I think, and this is something that I wrestle with a lot, is how do we align process with creative output? How do we make sure that when a brief comes through from a client, it has followed a proper process so that it's been interrogated effectively? And how do we ensure then as an agency, as we execute that brief, that there are sufficient guardrails in place to enable us to deliver properly? I see a constant conflict between creative output and the process that helps to get us there. So anybody who can add insight around that, I think, would be a very smart mind and somebody I'd love to engage with.
Awesome. Thanks, Charlie. It was a very insightful conversation. I think a lot to get out of that, especially on purpose, creative effectiveness, B2B marketing, and everything else that kind of contributes to those aspects. Thank you for your time.
Oh, thanks, Mongezi. It was great chatting.
Thank you for listening to The Lead Creative. Did you get one insight that's worth sharing from this episode? Please share it with your network or your friends. Pop me some of your ideas and innovative finds on Twitter on @Mongezi. This podcast is available on Spotify, Stitcher, Apple, Google, or wherever you listen to your podcasts. You can also find me on mongezi.com.